Good morning, everyone. We are reading in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, Canto 4, The Secret Knowledge. And we stopped on page 71 at line 905. So we'll begin reading today with the line, "In the vessel of an earthly embodiment." Last time we read that the soul, the Lord incarnate in material beings, he is the explorer and the mariner on a secret inner ocean without bourne, without any boundaries. He's the adventurer and cosmologist of a magic earth's obscure geography. So Sri Aurobindo continues this long image of the soul as an adventurer, a traveler, a sailor, in what we'll read today. What are you trying to tell me, Anandi?
I like you to read before, like that bigger the room. So, I like that.
We just heard Mother reading these lines. I think we'll let Narendra start today.
In the vessel of an earthly embodiment, over the narrow rails of limiting sense, he looks out on the magic waves of time, where mind like a moon illumines the world's dark. There is limned over, ever retreating from the eyes, as if in a tenuous, misty, dream light drawn, the outline of a dim, mysterious shore. A sailor on the inconscient, fathomless sea, he voyages through a starry world of thought on matter's deck to a spiritual sun. Across the noise and multitudinous cry, across the rapt, unknowable silences, through a strange mid-world under supernal skies, beyond Earth's longitudes and latitudes, his goal is fixed outside all present maps.
Thank you. Anyone would like to ask anything about these lines?
The word tenuous.
Sorry?
Tenuous.
Tenuous. Means very thin, very faint. It's a wonderfully poetic description of the voyage of the soul. His ship is his earthly embodiment, his body, in the vessel of an earthly embodiment. And you know, if you're in a sailing ship, or actually any kind of ship, there will be protective rails along the decks to prevent you falling over, falling into the ocean. So here it's the senses. There are these narrow rails of limiting sense. The way that we experience the world, it's through our sense impressions, no? And these sense impressions, they keep a kind of boundary for us, that we don't fall into the ocean of infinity. So he looks out over these narrow rails of limiting sense. He looks out, and his ship is sailing on the ocean of time. It's mostly a dark world, this ocean. We can't see very far into the future, no? Mind is like a moon lighting up the darkness of the world around us. A moon gives a reflected light. And when we look out over the narrow rails of limiting sense out into the future, there we see outlined, limbed, drawn, a line which is always retreating. As we go further, that line also is retreating from our eyes. And it's as if drawn in a very misty, dream light. It's not very, very clearly outlined, that line that we see ahead. It's the outline of a dim, mysterious shore. That's the shore which our boat is going to reach one day, which our traveller is going to reach one day, but we can't see it very clearly at all.
What does he mean by shore?
A shore is the beach.
I know, but where the soul is going, that's the question.
Yes, it's going to a distant, when you're in a boat, you may see far off on the horizon, you may just see a line. You don't know what that place is, no? But that's where the boat is carrying you to. And you see just the shore of it. It's the edge where the sea meets the land. Yeah. So that's a very dim, mysterious shore. We are not clear about our destination. The soul is a sailor, not only on the sea of time, but on the fathomless sea of the inconscient, of matter. And he's traveling through a starry world of thought. Stars light up this darkness for us with their gleams of truth. He's on the deck of his boat, the deck of our boat, the base that we can stand on is matter. But where we are traveling to is a spiritual sun. We're going to go far beyond matter. But on an ocean, there's always a noise. This is the ocean of time and the inconscient. There's a sound of the movement of the waters and a multitudinous cry, all the many, many creatures. But there's also sometimes absolute silence, wrapped, unknowable silences. He's traveling through a strange mid-world. In the ancient mythologies, our earth was thought to be a mid-world. And we have it in the Tolkien stories, no? Middle Earth. There's the heavens, and there are the nether regions, and here in the middle, our earth. But he says, this is a strange mid-world under supernal skies. It's not the skies of our familiar universe. He's traveling beyond Earth's longitudes and latitudes. It's a strange world that he's traveling in. His goal is fixed outside all present maps. Sri Aurobindo wrote that, but actually, of course, he has given us a map. Somebody in the ashram has even tried to draw that map. Not the divine plan, you might have seen it. At least Sri Aurobindo has explored this goal and described the journey to us. Poonam.
But man learns whither through the unknown he sails, or what secret mission the great mother gave in the hidden strands of her omnipotent will, driven by her breath, across life's tossing deep, through the thunder's roar, and through the windless hush, through fog and mist, where nothing more is seen. He carries her sealed orders in his breast. Late will he know, opening the mystic script, whether to a bland port in the unseen, he goes, or armed with her fiat, to discover a new mind and body in the city of God, and enshrine the immortal in his glory's house, and make the finite one with infinity.
Thank you. We're on page 71 at the bottom. But it seems as if even the soul doesn't know, none of us, where we are going. Whither means to where. None learns whither through the unknown he sails. And he doesn't know what is his secret mission. That's the great thing for all of us to find out. Each of us has a unique secret mission. And it's not the mariner who's steering the boat. He's being carried along by the mother's will, in the hidden strength of her omnipotent will, driven by her breath, like a sailing ship being driven by the wind, he gets carried across this tossing deep, this stormy sea of life. And there's all kinds of weather, through the thunder's roar when there are violent storms, and through the windless hush when everything's so still and quiet and nothing seems to move, through fog and mist where nothing more is seen. You can't even see the stars. You have no idea where your ship is moving to. Lorraine, you've got a friend. Would like to read Savitri with us. So he's got his mission written in sealed orders. It's written and he's carrying it in his breast. This is a military idea that people are sent out on secret missions and they themselves don't know where they're going and what they're supposed to do. Only at a certain stage they're authorized to take out the sealed orders and open them. So late will he know, opening that mystic script in which the orders are written, only then will he know what is his destination. Is he going to a blank port in the unseen, into the unknowable, merging in the invisible? Or is he armed with her fiat, with the mother's command? Is he empowered to discover a new mind and body in the city of God, where he will be asked to enshrine the immortal in his glory's house and make the finite one with infinity? Elsewhere in the book, this seems to be the mission that Sri Aurobindo foresees for us, to become embodiments of the divine being and to be able to make a link between the finite world where we are now and the transcendent infinity.
What is the difference between goal and mission?
Sorry?
Goal and mission.
Goal and mission. Goal is the place to where you are going. And the mission is the work you have to do on the way or when you get there. Yeah? Of course, they're connected. You'd read, Ravi?
Across the salt waste of the endless years, her ocean winds impel his errant boat. The cosmic waters flashing as he goes, a river around him, and danger and occur. Always he follows in her force wake. He sails through life and death and other life. He travels on through waking and through sleep. A power is on him from her occult force that ties him to his own creation's fate, and never can the mighty traveler rest, and never can the mystic voyage cease, till the nascent dust is lifted from man's soul, and the morns of God have overtaken his night.
Thank you. Such a beautiful picture, no? The salt waste. We can think of the ocean as a desert because nothing grows there. The salt waste, at least little grows there that human beings can use. But this is the ocean of time, the endless years. He's just being driven along by the mother's ocean winds, and his boat is wandering, errant. He's not steering it. He's only going where she carries him. So as he moves, the cosmic waters, that ocean, infinite ocean of the cosmos, they make this special sound, plashing. It's the sound of waves on the side of a wooden boat. It's a very special sound, plashing as he goes. And there's a rumor, a sound surrounding him, and he has to face danger. But there's also a call which is attracting him. And she's not only driving him, she's going on ahead in front of him. He has to follow in her wake, with a boat or ship moving quickly through the water. It leaves behind a trail. No? And fish and dolphins, they like to swim in that wake because it carries them along. There's a kind of drag of the ship, makes it easier for them to swim fast. No? So that's what's happening. The mother's going on ahead and attracting him behind her. And he has to sail through life and death and other life. The journey doesn't end. He travels on through waking and through sleep. And there's a power on him, a force of attraction from her occult force that ties him to his own creation's fate. Here the soul is the Lord, of course. No? He has created all this and he's connected to it by her force. So he can't rest, and this journey that he's taking can never end until the nescient dusk, this twilight of ignorance, is lifted from man's soul, and the morns of God, the dawns, the glorious mornings of God have overtaken his night. I suppose this happens on a journey, no? That the sun rises behind you, and as you move onwards, you may be moving in darkness or towards darkness, but the light comes and overtakes you. Sudanya.
As long as nature lasts, he too is there, for this is shown that he and she are one. Even when he sleeps, he keeps silent on his breast. Whoever leaves her will not depart to repose without her in the unbearable. There is a truth to know, a want to do. Her play is real, a mystery he fulfills. There is a plan in the mother's dream, warm wind, a purpose in her vast and random game. This ever she made since the first dawn of life. This constant will she covered with her soul to evoke a person in the impersonal void. With the truth light, strike earth's massive roots of strands, work a ground cell in the inconscient depth, and raise a lost form from its python sleep, that the eyes of the timeless might look out from time, and the words manifest the unveiled divine. For this he left his white infinity and laid on the sleep the burden of the flesh, that Godhead's seed might fall in mindless space.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. With these lines, Sri Aurobindo is summing up the secret knowledge that he wants to share with us in this part of the poem. He's shown us the two in one, but here he's really emphasizing it, that as long as nature lasts, he too is there. for this is sure that he and she are one. There's a beautiful illustration to these two lines. As you leave, you can have a look at that very mystical image that the mother has asked Hutta to depict. So because they are one, even when he sleeps, when he sees, this is perhaps the idea of the night of Brahma, when there's no manifestation, when the creator is sleeping, no? But he keeps his power on his breast. She's always with him. No? Whoever leaves her, he will not depart to repose without her in the unknowable. So many soul travelers have aimed to depart, to leave the manifestation, to escape from the bonds of nature and rest merged in the unknowable. But the Lord cannot do that. He will not depart to repose without her in the unknowable. So here Sri Aurobindo states his affirmative and dynamic vision of nature. It's not just to escape. There is a truth to know, a work to do. Her play is real. It's not an illusion. It's not Maya. And the soul embodied in nature is fulfilling a mystery, a secret process. There's a plan. Nature seems to be just at play, following her whim, but there's a plan in the mother's deep world whim, a purpose in her vast and random game. It seems to be random to us, but behind it all, she has an aim, a purpose. And now he's going to tell us what that purpose is. This, ever she meant, since the first dawn of life, this constant will she covered with her sport. She disguised it with all her play. Her purpose is to evoke a person in the impersonal void. And this impersonal void, emptiness or apparent emptiness of space, an individual being is to emerge from this. That's the first part of the aim. The second part of the aim is to strike Earth's massive roots of trance. This deep inconscience of matter should be struck as if by lightning, by the light of the truth consciousness. And that stroke of lightning should wake up a dumb self sleeping in the inconscient depths. That being there is imaged as a python, a gigantic snake, which is often equated with matter. But it's only asleep. It has to be woken up from its python sleep. The thing about a python is that they only eat, wake up and eat maybe once in a year or even longer, and then they sleep. When that power, that sleeping in matter, wakes up, the eyes of the timeless, of the supreme, the transcendent, will be able to look out through our time-born eyes. And this material world will be able to manifest the unveiled divine. Already all this is manifesting the divine, but under this disguise of matter. No? For this he, the Lord, the One, has left his white infinity, his pure white state beyond all limitations. He's laid on the spirit the burden, this heavy weight of the flesh, of being embodied in this material world. And he's done that for a reason, that Godhead's seed might flower in mindless space, scattering the seeds of divinity to blossom where there has only been unconscious emptiness before.
What do you think of the symbolism of, well, it's not even symbolism actually, that the use of the masculine pronoun and the feminine pronoun throughout this whole section of the Secret Knowledge, looking at the idea that she being this cosmic nature and he being this divine lord beyond creation. And then you also have the he who is the traveler.
Right.
Who is also she, because as a woman, I am the traveler.
Right.
And the man who is here, supposedly as a he, is also holding the nature which is personified here as a feminine.
Yes.
And so, you know, there's something, there are times when I want to just sort of change the pronoun here because it doesn't work for me.
Well, it's based on the ancient Indian traditional idea of the Lord who gives the command and the dynamic power, which is himself, his own dynamic power, which carries out the command. And that Lord, we read it, I think, last time. It's so interesting that he has accepted the rule of nature. He allows her. He's accepted that she shall give all the rules of the cosmic game, and he will just obey her. He will be embodied here as the soul in nature, and he will have to follow everything that she tells him to do. And first of all, it seems as if he's just her plaything or her slave, but then we're shown that actually she's driving him to rediscover his mastery. She's driving that nature is nourishing and helping the individual soul, which seems to be subject to material nature, driving him, making him ready for mastery and for control. And it's very interesting. I remember in a conversation of the mother with one of the teachers in the ashram school, she said, "Never forget you are a woman. You are the executive force." He says, you can, if you like, you can lean on the guidance or the concept of a man, but you are the one who has to do the implementation. And this is the idea of the mother giving birth to everything in the universe. That's why we worship her, because it's only through her that the Lord can be expressed in the world. He scatters the seed, but she has to see that everything flowers. So they are complementary in that way. And maybe this says something about the true relationship between men and women.
Here the nature is the cosmic nature, not the nature in human beings?
No, we are all products, children of cosmic nature, aren't we? Only our soul is representing the Lord. Everything else is hers. Yes, that's one of the ways that she expresses our individual Lord within us. She gives it an expression in our human nature.
Does the soul have a sex?
I think we think not. But anyway, here it's described as he. It has a gender, symbolically. But eventually we expect, and I think Mother has said, we will go beyond this distinction, but still these two in one will always be there. They are in all of us, and we are the way that they play their roles in the world, in time.
Gender is the manifestation.
Yeah, precisely, for this particular manifestation. There it's the earth nature calling to the Divine Mother to take possession of it. The Supreme Divine Mother. Just as the Lord plays here as soul, she plays as nature. So this lower nature can call to the highest nature, to Mother, come heal all this imperfection. That's in this book 3, canto 2, wonderful description of the Supreme Divine Mother. And somewhere else, in book 4, he speaks about all nature being at beauty's festival. That's the earth nature celebrating the birth of Savitri.
So
That's the wonderful thing about poetry. We can't do this kind of thing in prose. Prose appeals more to the logic of the reason. But poetry can put us in touch with what Schwerbinder calls the logic of the infinite. And it does that through these symbols, these wonderfully suggestive and flexible symbols. Somebody wanted to say something. Yes, please, Sudhanya. His white infinity. Yes, well, if we think about light, we think of pure light being white, colorless. No? But it can be split up by passing through a prism into all the colors, infinite number of colors. So I think it's that idea that the Lord, in his transcendent state, is pure white. It's when he manifests himself in the universe that he projects all the colors that are in him. All of us are colors of his oneness. That's one way of looking at it.
Yeah, like one color has created several colors.
Well, white is considered almost not a color. No?
Yeah.
It's beyond color. Yeah. Yes. But there are four petals, no?
Yes.
Aurobindo has written something about it, but I don't remember. For your exhibition, you must find this out.
Yes.
Yeah.
For the central power is the divine consciousness, then there's the four powers of the mother. So they're either white or gold, as Prasad said.
They are what?
Either white or gold. Yeah. So this is the mother. White is her.
Yes. Of course. That's the Lord in you, no? Right, yes. Yes. Like Aurobindo said, we are two for the play, no? And these are complementary. It's not that one is superior to the other. Both are necessary for the play.
To achieve the perfection.
Sorry?
To achieve the
perfection. Yeah. And that's why we can look forward to a future in which male and female aspects will be united in equally in everyone.
What was the reason she said like females will be females in next birth and males will be males? Because in Hindi mythology, it's interchangeable.
Mother says everything is possible,
yeah.
But there's a general rule. No? But she has given me a male name. No?
Yes.
How is Radhavan a male name?
Yes, but there's this ending. People used to tell me, Mother's made a mistake. It should have been Shraddhavati. I said, no, Mother doesn't make mistakes. And then a rather more experienced Sanskritist told me that this ending, Van, which we have with Bhagavan, then we say Bhagavati, no? That lady told me it's actually common. Like we say, man meaning human being, there's no fixed gender. It can be either. Right. Yes. Right.
And not the physical creation. I took a lot of my incarnations to develop skills.
So before we move on to the next canto, I think it's good if we just have a look back. There are seven sections in this canto. And each of them shares the secret knowledge in a different way. Well, we could just briefly look at that. So it begins on page 46. So it's in this section which he gives us the message that a death-bound littleness is not all we are. This mortal appearance that we have, that we've been born and we must die and we have to pass through this mortal life in the grip of death and ignorance. That's not all we are. We are carrying within us a greater self. It's living within us to ourselves unseen. And the fact that human beings can have extraordinary experiences of another consciousness and another life, he says that's a proof of this larger self that's living within us. And he describes it beautifully, the psychic being, as the murmuring tongue of a celestial fire. There's a heavenly fire that's burning with a little sound. It seems to perish with the mortal frame, but it doesn't. It carries on the journey through life and death and greater life. And that is our divinity. Always we bear in us. Now I'm reading on page 49 before the break. Always we bear in us a magic key concealed in life's hermetic envelope, a burning witness in the sanctuary, regards through time and the blind walls of form. A timeless light is in his hidden eyes. He sees the secret things no words can speak and knows the goal of the unconscious world and the heart of the mystery of the journeying years. This is the divine spark within us which has accepted incarnation and which gradually through this journey through time and evolution builds up around itself a personality, the psychic person, which gets by all our living experiences until it is developed enough, strong enough to step in the front and become the conscious leader of our existence, taking over from the vice-regent mind, which is our leader as human beings until the soul is ready to take over. And then in the second section, showed us the general earth consciousness, the consciousness of the earth as a whole. And he showed us the earth goddess toiling across the sands of time. As she goes, evolution takes its course. And that impulsion that's within her is leading to these further and further steps of evolution. And there comes a stage when she becomes aware of higher powers who are guiding our earth to meet its destiny, to meet the bliss which is its destiny. And on page 55, we have this wonderful prophecy about how, because of that guidance from above, the masked transcendent will mount his throne and waken up the soul first, and then the mind, and then the life and beauty shall conquer the resisting world. The truth light shall capture nature by surprise, a stealth of God compel the heart to bliss, and earth grow unexpectedly divine. She is our earth. She's the material principle that is embodied in this special globe. Of course, from the scientific point of view, because she represents the earth principle, and for the physicists and cosmologists, earth is just a little speck of matter like any other, and they are looking and looking and looking to see. They're sure they can find earth-like planets all over the place. No, there must be many of them. But Mother and Sri Aurobindo have spoken about this earth being a kind of special concentration of the nature consciousness, no, for a special purpose. And then they spoke also of India being a special concentration of the earth consciousness. So, for the work, and maybe in India, we feel, we believe that Auroville has a special concentration of the force, so that in Auroville, in India, on earth, can be woken up the possibilities of the future.
I have got some information, I don't remember the name of the scientist, but like Earth is the unique planet in all the galaxy that has, I don't remember how many parts of a lot of other planets, at least no other one there in the galaxy. It's only our Earth that has, I think, that 20 something from all the others. We are really unique.
Well, it's nice if the scientists are beginning to find evidence for this. Of course, all these individual creations, every one in the whole material universe, all contain a unique embodiment of the One, no? But if there's a special concentration here or there for a special purpose, yes. But still, they think it can't be that unique, no? Yeah. Scientists actually don't believe in uniqueness.
And they found some similar planets.
Like yeah, they're,
galaxy somewhere
they're,
like
yeah. They are looking, they call them exoplanets or something, that would allow life such as we have on Earth, consciousness that we have such as on Earth, to develop. And surely they will one day. That's the idea, no? That the whole material universe is going to be filled with light. According to the conventional physicists, it's actually running down. It's burning up all its fuel, and the sun is burning up all its fuel, and it's all going to go dark, and it's all going to go out. But they are not reckoning with this presence within. So Mother speaks about a creation that will go on forever and ever. Yes, Lorraine?
I was wondering about Stephen Hawking.
About Stephen Hawking, yes.
Because what keeps him real, animated, alive, that he's able to explore all these worlds? And
that's consciousness, isn't it? So then in the third section, he continues in another way of speaking about this earth consciousness, a consciousness that knows not its own truth, a vagrant hunter of misleading dawns between the being's dark and luminous ends, moves here in a half-light that seems the whole. And he speaks of this consciousness in terms of the universal word, the idea of the Om, which has its three syllables, and the fourth state is the whole word. And he says, here on our earth, it's as if these syllables have been split up. So we've forgotten all about our beginning and our end, and there's just this syllable of matter circling and cut off from the others. And because of that, because we don't see the context, the larger context of the universe, that's why we are in a state of ignorance. And what we really need to do is to put all this back together, to reconstitute the perfect word and unite the Alpha and the Omega in one sound. Then shall the spirit and nature be at one. And then he tells us about the two extremes of the mysterious plan. On the higher level, there are the spirit's bare and absolute potencies burning in the solitude of the thoughts of God. And he describes them to us, how remote they are from us and how it seems as if they have no interest in us at all. No? But then he modifies that. He says, yet a secret, a spiritual secret aid is there. There's a divine intervention to help us. And there's this outstretched hand is felt on our lives, and it's keeping safe for us our destiny. No? The one inevitable supreme result no will can take away and no doom change. The crown of conscious immortality, the Godhead promised to our struggling souls when first man's heart dared death and suffered life. One who has shaped this world is ever its Lord. Our errors are his steps upon the way. He works through the fierce vicissitudes of our lives. He works through the hard breath of battle and toil. He works through our sins and sorrows and our tears. His knowledge overrules our nescience. Whatever the appearance we must bear, whatever our strong ills and present fate, when nothing we can see but drift and bail, a mighty guidance leads us still through all. After we have served this great divided world, God's bliss and oneness are our inborn right. And then we read this beautiful paragraph about nature. Here, meanwhile, at the spirit's opposite pole, the conscious force that acts in nature's breast absolves from hour to hour her secret charge. She's carrying out her mission, and she's aware of the moment, the summit victory's vast descent, and the portent of the soul's immense uprise. She's carrying these clay images of unborn gods that are us, and she's making them ready to realize their Godhead. I was reading on page 60. So then we came to section 4, this rather short, beautiful section, which explains all here. This is on page 60 after the break, Anandi. All here, where each thing seems its lonely self, are figures of the soul transcendent one. Only by him they are. His breath is their life. An unseen presence molds the oblivious clay. Matter has forgotten, but that spirit, that of the one, the soul transcendent one, is inhabiting them and shaping them. And then we saw about him emanating the mother, and how in this world they have made their play with us for roles. He moves there as the soul, and as nature, she. That's what we were thinking about recently, just now. So we don't know how their drama's plan is going to play out. And it says even he has forgotten himself. He knows her only. The soul is aware only of nature, and he's forgotten himself. As one forgetting, he seeks for him, for his own self. And this whole world is only he and she. So we read about in the fifth section about the two who are one, this beautiful play of relationships between them. Whatever she desires, now I'm on page 66, just before the break. Whatever she desires, he wills to be. The spirit, the innumerable one, he has left behind his lone eternity. He is an endless birth in endless time. Her finite's multitude in an infinite space. And then there's another short section which begins, the master of existence lurks in us and plays at hide and seek with his own force. In nature's instrument, in each of us, secret God is loitering, playing in the universe. And here again, he reminds us of this promise that the Lord has made her a promise that for love of her and joined to her forever, he will follow the course of time's eternity. So that is how he becomes the explorer and the mariner, the adventurer and the cosmologist. A long beginning only has been made. And then the last section, which we completed earlier, about the sailor on the flow of time. One long image, which begins at the top of page 69 and continues to the end of the canto, showing us part of the journey of the soul through time. And then we read the summing up, which starts on line 946. Would you read from there, please, Patricia? Page 72, and the line is, as long as nature lasts.
There is a truth to know, a work to do. Her play is real, a mystery be fulfilled. There is a plan in the mother's deep world plan, a purpose in her vast and random game. This ever she meant since the first dawn of life. This constant will she covered with her sport to evoke a person in the impersonal void, with the truth light, strike Earth's massive roots of trance, wake a dumb self in the inconscient depth, and raise a lost power from its python sweep, that the eyes of the timeless might look out from time, and the world unveiled divine. For this he left his white infinity and laid on the spirit the burden of the flesh, that Godhead's seed might flower in mindless space.
Thank you. So this is a canto that in a way stands out from the narrative. Next week we'll continue with King Aswapati's yoga, and we'll see that this secret knowledge forms the basis. He receives this secret knowledge, and this forms the basis for the next steps of his journey. Mindless, without mind. It suggests without consciousness, empty space in which there's no life and there's no mind. In that emptiness, the seed of divinity must blossom, fill it all. So that's why I feel, you know, the whole universe is going to be transformed eventually. That's the intention. It's not just going to fade away. Let's listen to Mother reading some lines.
As long as nature lasts, he too is there, for this is sure, that he and she are one. This constant will she covered with her spore to evoke a person in the universe.
Thanks to Sri Aurobindo.